This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, I'm Sharad Kutan, and welcome to the show that walks you through some fundamental concepts in the social sciences and humanities. Together with Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, the show tries to reveal how various thinkers have grappled with theories and frameworks that better to understand how society works. Each week, we discuss a classic text or an idea that we hope will shed light on the world around you. And this week, we're talking about human rights. It's an idea that's been around for some time, but very recently attacked in this country by our very own Prime Minister, who then subsequently issued a correction on that. And it's led to some debate, I think, about what was going on. I mean, what exactly was he referring to? Mm-hmm. And those who came out in defense of him said that he was talking about extreme forms of human rights. And so, you know, the question is, can there be extreme forms of human rights, and what does that mean? So, Fuad, where do we start when we want to talk about human rights?
Well, I figured today, given that it's entered public discourse so suddenly and quite at a mainstream level as well, given that that statement was made by the Prime Minister himself, we could just start with basically trying to understand what it is. And what are some of the problems with it? Because it doesn't feel like it here, but there are actually discussions about the problems with the concept itself and the problems with how to best communicate or promote it, so on and so forth. So we'll try to have a balanced approach today.
Do you want to begin the debate in a historical fashion? I mean, meaning locate the emergence of human rights discourse in terms of certain legal frameworks, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights?
Yeah.
Or do you want to talk about the ideas embedded in the discourse that perhaps predate that?
Let's talk about the ideas, because as you rightly pointed out, human rights has taken many forms. So some people, some progressive Muslims, for example, would argue that the Medina Charter is an expression of human rights. And then there's, of course, the Magna Carta later on in England that was taken to be a kind of nascent version of human rights. And so there are these different expressions. But fundamentally, what they all try to capture is the articulation of the rights, the fundamental rights by which humans deserve on the basis of being humans. So, you know, rights is just another fancy word of saying entitlement. So what these rights try to secure, try to present are entitlements that any human beings should have because they would safeguard or allow for the exercise of human life. So this is why you have the freedom of speech as part of human rights, freedom of expression, freedom of religion, freedom of thought. Workers' rights fall under human rights as well because these are taken to safeguard human life, basically. And that's essentially what human rights really mean.
Isn't human rights essentially a secular ideology in the sense that the entitlements that men have coming out of this discourse really are not framed in terms of them being created by a god, and that the rights endowed in them really emanate from a source outside them, as opposed to a much more secular view of things, which is that, you know, by the sheer fact that you are human, that you get it. You know, you don't get it because there's a God who created you.
Right. Well, there are both forms in history. So if you look at Thomas Aquinas, he had natural law. And natural law essentially is right and wrong. Natural law deems that right and wrong must be measured in accordance to some notion of human nature. And he felt that this notion of human nature must be tied to some notion of the divine, for it to make sense. But that's not that different from the kind of notion of the human person that we have today. Although that you said, you know, it is secular, but it does have some commitment toward human nature, right? Because human nature explains what a human person is. And we cannot talk about rights or fundamental entitlements if we do not have some sense of what human being is. So ultimately, whether it's secular or religious, those are very great differences. They both aim to identify the ethical bounds of being human based on an understanding of human nature. Hence, like you said too, how how and why much of human rights rhetoric point to inalienability and inherent values, right? Because there's something essential to being human that these rights are supposed to protect.
Well, so that brings us to some really important distinctions that need to be kind of established at the start of this debate, which is, what is it to be human?
Mm-hmm.
And we know that throughout history, not every human being was accorded
exactly
the status of being human. So mm-hmm. that's one thing. And it is in view of that history that perhaps we also can understand the importance of human rights. Certain human individuals and communities were, in fact, denied their humanity.
Mm-hmm.
Say, for instance, you know, African people in the context of South Africa under apartheid, for instance,
mm-hmm.
Or even earlier in racist ideologies that deny the humanity.
Correct.
The other thing, of course, is, and I'm wondering if, you know, we want to get into this, which is the question of, I mean, are we so distinct as a species
right.
that we can deny the same rights to those that are not of our species, including cousin primates, for
mm-hmm.
instance,
mm-hmm.
or even just the run-of-the-mill mammals that we
right.
see, you know, around us? And I think that that's perhaps
yeah.
something that's a bit
well,
too far.
We can touch on
here,
it probably in the second part.
Yeah,
you know, because,
but there,
yeah.
there is a question, and I think we mustn't, in
no,
some
that's
ways,
true.
We must keep that in the mix somehow, maybe bracket it for a while. But okay, so be that as it may, we think we understand what it is to be human, and we, I guess, assume in this day and age that everybody who's human in a kind of a biological sense is now endowed or cannot be denied
mm-hmm.
their rights to be called a human.
Correct. Although that was never clear for the longest time, you know, I think we take it for granted that it's obvious now. But if you just look at how long human history endured with, you know, a less than obvious or less than clear understanding of what constitutes human person, it's quite disturbing. Like you said, the fact that, you know, just take, for example, the fact that slavery existed for hundreds of years, while various, you know, ethical frameworks and notions of human, you know, human entitlement were already prevalent. It's more than just getting the definition right. It's about how do you manifest these values into, you know, actual concrete living conditions.
It's very deeply political, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's somewhat like a club, right? And it's like talking about Athenian democracy. When we talk about democracy today, we're thinking of that all adults have the franchise, that they have those
mm-hmm.
rights.
Mm-hmm.
But because Athenian democracy denied women the franchise, they denied slaves the franchise,
mm-hmm.
or other human beings, but who weren't part of the club.
Mm-hmm.
And
but this is a good example. You know, Hannah Arendt in The Human Condition explains this interestingly. She said that for Athenian democracy, especially how it was understood by Aristotle, to be human is to be free from necessity. And that is, in other words, is to be free from laboring for your needs. Hence, a slave isn't free because a slave has to do that for someone else for himself, you know? So that's a very different notion of being free than, say, the kind of liberal human rights notion that we have now, where these values of freedom are just endowed in us, you know? So you're right. It's not very clear, yeah.
Yeah, in some ways, you know, those critics of democracy, and I think maybe even liberals who are frustrated with the trajectory of democracies, whether in this country or otherwise, will say, well, not everybody should have the right to vote.
Mm-hmm.
And because of their frustrations about people who they think are not educated enough, who don't participate and think deeply enough about politics, but who have an equal right to vote.
Exactly.
And, you know, an equal weightage in terms of their vote. So, I mean, those are the kinds of impulses, I think, that have been in human society for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Who really should be governing society? Because, after all, the right to vote is about governance.
Exactly.
And in many ways, the question of rights is linked to, in some sense, to the questions of power.
Correct,
right?
Correct. And this is a problem. If we all do ascribe to the belief that everybody is endowed with some quality of inherent freedom or something like that, then how should it manifest in these real life terms, right? Obviously, we suspend some of these rights in a very common sense way. You know, for example, like with children. Of course, children have rights, but we know that they don't have the rights of full political participation in a community, right? Like voting, like purchasing weapons and all that. Because we know ultimately that you require some understanding of one's role as a citizen, what a citizen should and can expect from society, so on and so forth, before you can actually exercise these rights. So while rhetorically it does sound appealing to think that there is this blanket equality of inherent freedom. How it manifests is a completely different question. Yeah.
Now, when you think about children and that whole process of perhaps not denying the humanity of communities, but in fact infantilizing them. So you think of colonial histories where entire nations and communities were infantilized, were made childlike in order to justify the dominance of a particular, you know, power, to say, well, actually, we're not oppressing them. Mm-hmm. We're looking after them as if we were parents and they were children. And so we deny them these rights mm-hmm. because they're under a process of tutelage, for instance.
Right?
So you have that kind of language. And you still hear that, actually, yeah. in many kind of post-colonial societies with authoritarian governments, that they tried, they can't deny the humanity of their citizens, but what they can do is undermine it by infantilizing their mm-hmm. populations, by claiming that they're not ready to take full control of their responsibilities and, more importantly, their rights as individuals.
Correct. And I think this points to a key content of human rights as we know it today, and that is the emphasis on the human person's rational capacities. Right, so the reason why adulthood is prioritized compared to infancy is because of that, the presumption that as an adult you would have been habituated, cultivated enough to know what's right and wrong through the use of reason. And reason here is seen as the adjudicator and the guardian of our choices and individual lives. So the reason why one can appeal to human rights in a moral sense, not just a legal, practical sense, but a moral sense, to defend one's decision is because one is an adult who is capable of exercising one's rationality to make ethical decisions for oneself. And this parallels neatly with the story of human evolution that the West, especially throughout its colonial expansion, prided itself over for being a more rational civilization. So there is this clear place that rationality has in this discourse.
So then also begs several questions, right? I mean, this gets more and more complicated because I do agree that in some sense we can suspend certain rights for children, things, people we consider, individuals we consider children. But the question is, where is that line between childhood and adulthood? Mm-hmm. These are not natural lines.
No, they're not. They're not,
you know, my yeah. grandmother was married off at 12. I mean, if you can get married, you think you should be able to vote, right? Mm-hmm. But we draw these arbitrary lines and we agree that regardless of the person's personal capacities or to enter into a rational debate or informed debate, we give them the right. They have a right to vote regardless of, mm-hmm. you know, their educational standards. But then there's this whole other class of people who we continue to deny rights to for two reasons. One is insanity. We believe they're mentally incapable mm-hmm. of it. And we do, in fact, take away the rights of people we think are mentally handicapped or whatever. And the other, because they're criminals. So criminals are also another class of humanity that can be denied rights. So actually, when you start looking at this very question of who has rights, who doesn't have rights, you really get into some interesting areas.
And it's not clear cut. All these things have to go through real sustained deliberation, and I think this is where it's important to really check ourselves when we think of rights. And even when we talk about them, do we mean them as just the entitlements that a government should protect and offer? Or are we talking about the very moral foundation of that? And oftentimes, people are not very clear on this. They think, the government should protect my right to speak. I mean, they know that it's the right to speak, the access to speak, the freedom to speak, so on and so forth. But there are, like you said, more foundational questions that point to more complex stuff behind it. Yeah.
So coming up next, we will explore further the question of human rights. Until then, you've been listening to Ahmad Fuad Rahmat. Myself, Sharad Kutid. This is Night School on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, this is Night School. I'm Sharad Kutin along with Ahmad Fuad Rahmat. We've been talking about human rights.
Okay, if you just joined us, we spent the first half of the show broadly talking about the definition of human rights and some of the issues in it and how it's very complex, and that the complexity is inherent in the very subject that it tries to protect, which is the human person. And we also mentioned in the beginning that the Prime Minister himself has spoken against human rights quite clearly, although only to retract eventually to qualify his statement. But I think we should look at that in a broader framework, in the larger discourse that's been happening among the Muslim intelligentsia in this country. You know, English-speaking Muslims, Malay-speaking Muslims, locally educated Muslims, overseas educated Muslims. And there is this real, I wouldn't say suspicion, but distance towards the topic. And I think one of the things that we can do, since we've already discussed the definition, is to look a bit at some of the reasons why suspicions about human rights persist.
The way in which critics of human rights deal with human rights is to demonize it, to link it to particular unpopular causes, like, say, mm-hmm. the rights of the LGBT community, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. or unfettered freedoms to insult religion and such, right? So these are strategies, rhetorical strategies, that basically pit human rights against, say, a faith-based notion of the world, mm-hmm. you know. So how do we begin to even deal with that? I mean, even if, for instance, somebody came to the question of human rights without those prejudices within the kind of Islamic landscape of, you know, the critical landscape, what would they still need to contend with?
Well, they have a very different notion of the human person in that it is created by God, and that what is right and wrong for this human person is to be determined by the sources that is connected to that God. So rather than to see rationality, you know, unbridled and pure in our access of it as a source of ethics, they would couple that with engagement with the Quran and the Hadith and all that. So the process, and because the process is different, and the outcome will lead to different conclusions and definitely a different kind of discourse. So what you end up having is this gap between those who would ascribe to the more secular / quote-unquote Western manifestation of human rights and one that is more loyal to the scriptures and the sayings of the Prophet and Islamic history.
So the question is, the political frame for this debate is interesting, because if we lived in a caliphate, if we lived with, you know, leaders who are divinely chosen, or we believe are divinely chosen, and we weren't citizens but just subjects of that realm mm-hmm. of power and influence, then you'd have perhaps the basis to make that argument. But if I argued that actually we live in a modern nation state, mm-hmm. we are all citizens, and that is in fact the foundation, that is the non-negotiable in this discourse. So we're all citizens. And as a consequence, one can't take as one's reference something otherworldly, like a god and all those texts that come out of it.
There's a couple of rhetorical sleight of hands that they can pull here. The first would be to do what our guest last week did, which is to say, well, if you acknowledge me as a citizen of the society, and I too have rights, then I too should have the right to live in accordance with my value system. And I too should have the right to speak out against a value system that I feel is alien to me. So by that, they stay in the discourse.
Yes, but you're right to, and I absolutely agree, mm-hmm. you have the right to live within your value system, but your right to do that is guaranteed by something other than that value system. It's guaranteed by a secular frame and a foundation that sees us as all able to live within with our value systems, but still within a compact. And the compact is what we call citizenship. Right?
Yeah.
And human rights is intimately tied up with the concept of citizenship, isn't it not?
It is. There are two sleights of hand that they can play here too. The first would be to say that to concede that the current system is enabling their rights, but to show their very deep faults and problems in the current system. And then to show that these problems are tied to an ethical deficiency in the very system itself. So they can say that having their value system can enrich the discussion and in fact even fill in the blanks where those problems cannot be solved by the secular liberal system itself.
You give an example?
Yeah, there are some examples. The first is the notion of individualism that's deeply embedded in the Western secular notion of rights, that has, you know, some communitarians would say has been inflated to a level where it's no longer sustainable. So they would point out that, you know, under a kind of secular, rational, liberal framework, you have great inequality because you have private, you know, notion of individual private property is been, you know, maximized to this point. And then, of course, consumption leads to the destruction of environment, so on and so forth. This is not an aberration of human rights. They would say that this is particularly tied to the idea of a secular, unbridled, you know, absolutely free kind of ideal for individual that we try to strive. So they would say, and people like that even make the arguments here in this country, there's something tanks that still do this. They say, like, you know, if we have a better notion of individual that is, recognizes the divine in nature, that recognizes the importance of knowledge, so on and so forth, all these problems wouldn't get to this point to begin with, you know. So, I mean, these are the kind of arguments that pop up in the discussions and all that, yeah.
You know, I interviewed the UN Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Expression, he had a very interesting definition of what human rights is. And he said that human rights is a minimal standard, right? And not a maximum one. It's not about imposing your values on others. It's about saying, this is what is necessary for all of us to claim our humanity in terms of some practices. Cultural specificity, cultural difference can all be accommodated, perhaps, sort of negotiated and managed as a consequence, but within that framework. So you can still have these minimal standards and then on which you can build your cultural difference and whatnot. But you cannot argue against those minimal standards.
Yeah, but I agree with that. I have no problems with that. My only concern is that it does not appear minimal to a lot of people. We have to see that once human rights is understood as a set of values, it can be easily contestable because everybody is coming with different sets of values. Even secular atheist people, you know, can have values that contradict secular liberal notions of human rights. You know, if you're just a materialist, if you just think that human beings are just a complex working of, you know, an aggregate of different biological machinations, that notions of inherent value and inalienable dignity are just metaphysical wishwash. Then what's that? You know, you just look at rights as something that's practical, that whatever the government can protect given, you know, its capacity in a given time. You know, but when you say that you're upholding these rights to protect the human being, so that the human being can exercise its whatever it believes its happiness should be, then you're getting into rather murky terrain like we have now, you know, which is why these kind of discussions keep coming up, because it's really a very contested terrain.
I think behind any of these dispensations, the religious one, or in this era, the dominance of a kind of secular human rights based one, is the question of power. I mean, who is supporting these value systems and frameworks, right?
Correct.
So it was never God who was working, or, you know, walking around the world and arranging things, right?
Yeah.
It's people claiming God, but they always had the sword with them. They could always enforce their notion of that moral framework. And I think human rights discourse is no different from it. We have legal systems, but we also have the gunboat, and we also have all kinds of other means in order to enforce
the
framework.
The Malaysian human rights circle, I think, took a real severe blow when Obama came here, and when they had, you know, asked to meet Obama, and not only that, asked Obama to help with the Malaysia's human rights situation here, and there were many among my friends, relatives, who felt that was hypocritical. I mean, this guy drones children and villages in Pakistan in his sleep, literally. I mean, that's what's happening in it while he sleeps. And America has the highest incarceration rate, still has the death penalty. And yet, you know, many of us seem to think that we can hope through this guy. And what happens there is that people who are not so sold on human rights in the first place will start wondering, you know, what it's about, and if people, and B, if people who are championing it actually understand it. So
But Obama himself doesn't lead to the collapse of the system, right? Because, yes, I mean, I think they're probably mistaken, mm-hmm. and I agree with you. I mean, I think they are mistaken in hoping that Obama can do this or that. In fact, the imam of the National Mosque also asked Obama for help, mm-hmm. asking him to protect mm-hmm. Muslim communities around the world. I mean, everybody asks Obama for something, right? Mm-hmm. But, you know, but that's not the point. The point really is, what I was trying to suggest is that we never escape power in relation to these moral and ethical frameworks that we want to Correct. Have undergrid society. That, you know, we'll always move from one to the other. And that's not a bad thing. It's just the nature thing. I think, you know, Walter Benjamin once said, you know, every document of civilization is
a document of barbarism. And I think in that sense, I have no problems with that. If we in the human rights, among human rights advocates, can really say that, that it's really a power game as well as a values game, that you cannot separate power from values or values from power, that if you really want society to change for the better, you have to play dirty.
Well, no. Yeah. There's a slip on your part. I don't think it's about playing dirty. I think here power is not so much about playing dirty, but here is recognizing that enforcement is crucial to the way in which laws and values are upheld, right? So enforcement requires legitimate use of force. I mean, so those who go against those laws must be punished. Otherwise, it's pointless having those laws.
Sure.
And, you know, and I think that for advocates of human rights, and like myself, you know, I do believe that human rights have moved us in a progressive way, away from, you know, arbitrary rule.
Sure, definitely.
You know, away from the lack of transparency in governance. And
divine rule of kings, yeah.
You know, and the persecution of, you know, vulnerable communities. I mean, the whole host reason why the human rights frameworks, in fact, do raise the bar on human civilization, make it a much more livable place for a huge number of peoples. But it does still have failings. You know, I would
I agree with that. But the thing is, the failings, we don't have to talk about the failings, I guess we might get to murky territory, but we have to, in making change, people will get hurt. Either their value systems will have to be under attack. You know, the value system racist, I have no problems attacking that, right? I mean, we're all doing that. But it seems that if we really want to make human rights a more prominent aspect of our political culture, the scope has to be widened, and this will require some sort of conflict and offense as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think, you know, we look in some societies that, you know, maybe liberals are very quick to caricature, right? So the denial of the right of the girl child to have education. We think of it's a natural right. It would be impossible in our circles to argue against the rights of girl children. But within a certain context, I mean, there are cultural and social reasons why some people feel that girl children shouldn't be mm-hmm. in the public sphere. They shouldn't be engaged in these kinds of activities, right? But we never credit them with any kind of logic except the most brutal one, which is there is kind of an irrational desire to rob women of any kind of social power and such. And you can imagine all the other ways in which we can say maybe caricature the Taliban, for instance. I mean, for me, the difficulty is how do we begin to think, not with empathy, but at least with intellectually, with a certain generosity, to think, where have they come from?
Here's a very simple rule of thumb that I use when I teach this. And that's to see human rights as something very impersonal. You know, just think about it this way. A very simple thought experiment is among your friends or your family, you don't evoke rights, you know, unless it's really bad, right? Like, but between you and me, you know, I don't say, even if there's a conflict, even if there's a problem, I won't say, you're denying my right to my inalienable values. You know, we don't have to go there because we know ultimately that there is some ground of familiarity, some ground of trust that we can turn to adjudicate and overcome issues, right? It only becomes more prominent when there is a greater gap between communities or individuals, right? And this is a very interesting manifestation of how the notion of rights, because it's tied very closely to resolving issues, right? So it aims to resolve more than it aims to really heal necessarily. That human rights become very legalistic, you know. So that's the first thing to do. I mean, you're right. We don't have to sympathize with the Taliban. That's not what you're asking for. But to see that why it is that sometimes the immediate reaction when evoking rights it takes a distinctly crude form, right? And sometimes it doesn't even help. But it's because when sometimes, even by impulse, that we start evoking these rights, there's already this gap, whether in communication, whether in wavelength or something. And that this gap, human rights advocates think, rightly or wrongly, human rights can somehow solve. You know, but yeah. I think we have to be more careful with that.
Yeah, so I think so far, just quick summary, I think you point to clearly the geopolitical use of human rights discourse, right? I mean, Obama is a classic example. Hillary Clinton, I think, famously saying that the fight in Afghanistan was about giving rights to, you know, the girl child. I mean, it's the most ludicrous kind of claim to make, because obviously there are geopolitical considerations. I mean, you know, America's not rushing into every situation to help the most vulnerable. In fact, as you rightly point out, they do, in fact, you know, prey on the vulnerability of right. certain communities. But the other issue, of course, is the way in which we think about human rights, not as a way of resolving all problems, but in a very, they resolve certain problems.
Correct.
And they're directed at resolving especially the power differential between states and individuals within those states, mm-hmm. right? So that's another area of kind of conceptually getting some sort of clarity.
Correct.
What else can human rights, I mean, if I'm an advocate and I want to say, well, actually, there's some reasons to root for the spread of human rights discourse, what else would I be looking at?
Conceptually, you have to see that currently human rights discourse is tied to institutions that have their own interests. And these interests might not be bad, but these are just institutions with their own interests, and they will use power to express those interests. So we can contextualize how the discourse has become so prominent by keeping that in mind, you know, that as a movement, as activists, as people who are concerned to pursue certain changes through the human rights mechanism, there is always already a background of institutions and their particular history. In this case, the United Nations, for example. And with that, it's its own history in being the construction of certain victors after the Second World War, so its own geopolitical realities as well. So it's best, I think, personally, to not think of it in the abstract. I mean, there are many ways to improve things even without human rights, right? Like basic values of dignity and respect, right? They don't always have to be articulated in terms of rights, you know, or never mind, or human rights and their metaphysical baggage. So those things are useful to keep in mind, I think.
But what could we, I mean, is the vocabulary of human rights? I know you see some deficiencies there.
Sure.
But isn't the vocabulary something and those frameworks important in educating us to think about how to think about, say, children, or to think about gender issues or thinking about culture and communities? I mean, doesn't human rights give us tools in order to negotiate the complexities of, you know, modern society?
It does. I think the most important tool is autonomy. The idea that each person or each community, however complex that community is defined, has some notion of self-determination and self-constitution. I think that's very important.
And I think also universality, you know, and indivisibility, right?
But I do ascribe to, of course, you know, inherent dignity and all that, but I don't know if human rights necessarily is adequate to address that, although it has good starting points.
Well, you know, we've come really to the end of the show, and what would you recommend people read?
I would suggest Michael Walzer's Ethics, Thick or Thin, and he introduces thin conceptions of the good and thick conceptions of the good, which I think it's not a book about human rights necessarily, but the good. You know, human rights is one model of the good, and other people have others, right? And they don't always neatly converge. And that book is a good explanation of why. And he uses two terms, thick and thin, to explain it. Thick being robust notions of the good, and thin being kind of like the minimal standard that that you mentioned of just now. And these are problems, because people don't live with minimal standards. We always go about life with some robust notion of flourishing, right and wrong, so on and so forth. So, but it is nonetheless minimal standards that governments can afford the most to stay sustainable democratically, right? So you have these things to juggle, yeah.
What I'm impressed by when listening to politicians is how they create these chains of equivalence, right? So it's not just human rights. Human rights, it's secularism, it's liberalism, you know,
modernity.
Yeah. I mean, there are a number of things that become lumped into this basket of bad things. I mean, we're looking at the critics of human rights. And I think it'd be worthwhile to see what is different about each of those terms. And how is it that they're linked together? Mm-hmm. So maybe that in a kind of a game we might play with ourselves when we're listening to politicians mm-hmm. is to ask ourselves, what is it they're trying to do?
Right.
And what are they trying to hide by making those equivalences?
One last word of advice for anybody seeking to embrace human rights. Don't make it another religion, please. You know, that means don't make it beyond criticism, or don't hide yourself from the historical or conceptual limits, you know, or else then we'll just have more dogmatism in the discourse and at times even more fanaticism. I think it's, you know, I think I'm behind human rights first and foremost as a way to get things done here. But I think, you know, we should keep in mind that it's also one perspective among others then, and that makes it a healthier process.
Well, that's all we have. You can add to this conversation on our Facebook page at BFM Night School. You can also send us an email. We can add to that way, and you can write to us at
bfmnightschool@gmail.com.
You've been listening to myself, Sharad Kutin, and of course, Ahmad Fuad Rahmat. This has been Night School on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.